region during the 1875 to 1914 period have also identified major growths of Orientalism, spiritualism, and even Victorian-era speaking in tongues, akin to recent U.S. trends, save that the British version of other directed speech was occultism and a fascination with mediums who would have remote experiences reported from the other side and putting seekers in touch with departed relatives and friends. But when the Armageddon of 1914 to 1918 brought 40 million deaths instead of Christ's return, the embarrassment was not limited to flag-bedecked Anglican churches or nonconformist chapels that had joined in the parade. Religion in general seemed to have failed, and British church attendance shrank, and then shrank again. It is not hard to imagine something similar happening in the United States by 2030 or 2040, as two or three decades of cynicism claim religious as well as economic and political victims. Evangelicalism under George W. Bush probably expanded to levels of adherence and belief that it will be unable to sustain much further into the 21st century. However, that will certainly not happen overnight, because the end times imagery of the early 21st century, from tsunamis and terrible hurricanes and the AIDS crisis to the rise of Iraq, followed by China, the trauma of oil, and even financial panic, lends itself too well to religious end times explanation to dissipate in the face of anything much less than a World War I equivalent. In the meantime, much of the rest of the world, even Europe and to a smaller extent Britain, Canada, and Australia, has come to talk about the United States becoming undependable and even an altogether different culture from itself. The widespread biblical and left-behind sort of religiosity is often cited as the explanation, although few foreign observers comprehend its contours or depth. In the first wave of world disillusionment with the United States in late 2002 and 2003, as the invasion of Iraq loomed, international polling by the Pew Center and others found many respondents singling out George W. Bush for blame, not Americans as a whole. The first international polls taken as the United States was preparing to invade Iraq surprised Americans with findings that most foreigners were hostile to the invasion, but focused much of their negativism on George W. Bush. By 2004 and 2005, however, the result became hostile in a deeper way. The Pew Global Attitudes Study for 2004, based on some 6,500 interviews in 8 countries in addition to the United States, found that respondents in every nation but the United States said the war in Iraq had hurt, not helped, the war on terrorism. Only in Britain did a majority of those queried believe the U.S. war on terror was sincerely directed against international terrorism. Others thought it was insincere and principally aimed at controlling Middle Eastern oil. People from the 4 participating countries belonging to NATO, allies like Britain, Germany, Turkey, and France, favored Western Europe's taking a more independent approach to diplomatic and security affairs and reducing its association with the United States. In 2005, the Pew Global Attitudes probe found new dimensions of dissatisfaction. Startling majorities said their views of the United States had become less favorable because of the re-election of George W. Bush. 77% in Germany, 75% in Canada, 74% in France, 62% in Britain. In France, the Netherlands, Britain, and Germany, majorities or pluralities said the United States was too religious, and most participants favored the emergence of some nation or multinational union as a military counter to the United States. When respondents were asked to indicate favorable or unfavorable attitudes toward 5 specific nations, the U.S., Germany, France, Japan, and China, the British, French, Germans, Spanish, Dutch, and Russians gave their lowest marks to the United States. Only Canadians did not, but their criticism flared up in other ways, because Canadians gave Americans the highest negatives for being violent and greedy. Not only have the last several years witnessed the most global defeat for the U.S. public diplomacy and the nation's reputation since the interplay of defeat in Vietnam and the Watergate scandal in the 1970s, but the direct tie to the Bush administration is unmistakable. Indeed, the divisions within the U.S. electorate make it difficult to suggest that Bush is unique. Whereas Americans who declined to vote for Bush generally agreed that U.S. policy has made enemies and disaffected much of the world, the bulk of Bush's huge evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal constituency did not think so. Its members believe that the United States remains both strong and respected. The problem, to an extent, is that within the United States they have their own communication system and culture built around belief, both religious and scriptural. Many of the evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal churches, especially the megachurches, become the principal source of both belief and information in their congregations' lives. Broadcast, publishing, and direct mail empires have grown up around these fellowships and communities, creating umbrellas against the effects of secular communications. The viewpoints of so-called sophisticates have little access to the minds of the faithful. Thus, for example, majorities of Americans continue to believe in Noah's Ark and the Book of Genesis version of creation, even though a recent report by genome researchers found that chimpanzees and humans share a very similar genetic blueprint, a 96% overlap, which scientists call overwhelming evidence of Darwin's theory of evolution. Similarly, even though the major oil companies have started to concede that a peak of world oil production may be close, true believers continue to believe that God will provide. If holders of these religious views were not a very large, albeit minority, bloc of the population, George W. Bush would not have been reelected. Their ranks may be close to their peak, but that prediction cannot be offered as fact. Difficult politics thus lies ahead. Unfortunately, the history of past leading world economic powers is that they have not been able to throw up the sort of leadership needed to reverse the tides involved. In consequence, the nations in the process of being dethroned as the world's economic leader have faced a difficult period of 20 to 40 years, at very least, in making the transition from yesterday's hegemony to a lesser but eventually comfortable role in a differently shaped world. In the United States, elements of economic sclerosis seem to go hand in hand with the political variety. In mid-2005, for the first time since measurement began, household incomes failed to increase for 5 straight years. Median pre-tax income, said the Census Bureau, was at its lowest point, adjusted to inflation, since 1997. Meanwhile, buoyed by federal policy, those enjoying the top 1% of U.S. incomes continued to increase their share of the national pie. When Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan acknowledged that 7% of personal disposable income in 2004 had come from households borrowing against home values, up from 3% in 2000 and 1% in 1994, he followed an earlier and equally telling admission, that asset values had become a prime focus of Washington decision-making. Our forecasts, said Greenspan, are becoming increasingly driven by asset price changes. Edwardian England and mid-18th century Holland shared some of those preoccupations. American energy policy had its own ennui and interest group commitments. Ineptitude in Iraq worsened matters, but the government took no serious measures to curb public fuel consumption, or for that matter, to curb attitudes that offended oil and gas supplying nations, from Canada and Venezuela to the Muslim Middle East. In 2004, the New York Times pointed out, the U.S. Energy Information Administration issued forecasts that by 2020, Saudi Arabia would produce 18.2 million barrels of oil a day. No reliable information was involved. The agency simply assumed that Saudi Arabia would be able to produce whatever the United States needed it to produce. This complacency had its own precedents. As coal-rich Britain went to war in 1914, it became clear that for a century, her politicians had neglected the strategic raw materials, from bauxite and non-ferrous metals to oil, that would eventually become vital. 4 years after the First World War ended, the history of the British Ministry of Munitions candidly described the severity of the negligence. The early 21st century United States, in turn, seems as neglectful of the Chinese challenge as early 20th century Britain was of the German one. As we have seen, in 2005 polls, the populations of many supposed U.S. allies rated China more favorably than they did the United States, and scarcely a week goes by without reports of the Chinese cutting new oil and gas deals with Canada, Latin America, and the Middle East. On top of this, the Chinese have the sort of pioneering record in energy that the Germans circa 1900 had in science, chemistry, and engineering. Not long ago, one Chinese website posted impressive petroleum-related references from the 11th century Mengzi Bitan volumes. The lesson of the past is that timely reforms do not emerge, and deep, unanswerable national issues generate weak and compromising politicians or zealous bumblers. Second-raters certainly dominated in Spain and Holland. So too in Britain. Indeed, the collapse of the World War I coalition government under Lloyd George was followed, in the nearly two decades prior to Winston Churchill's wartime accession in 1940, by a quartet of second-rate prime ministers and ineffective coalitions. The four prime ministers in question, Bonner Law, Ramsay MacDonald, Stanley Baldwin, and Neville Chamberlain, are remembered as historical pygmies in the towering company of the Walpoles, Pitts, Gladstones, and Disraelis who governed during Britain's 18th and 19th century ascent. Depending on how history looks back from the 2010s and 2020s, the two Bush presidents could be associated with U.S. decline in a way that the hard-to-remember leaders of ebbing Spain, Holland, and Britain avoided. The U.S. difficulty in facing these problems has been matched by a similar failure of leadership, incapacity of the parties, and aristocratization or sclerosis of institutions. One troubling aspect is the phenomenon I discussed in 2004 in American Dynasty. This is the emergence within the U.S. system of a great family politics, most vivid on the Republican side in the mediocre father-son inheritance of the Bush dynasty, but also debilitating for the Democratic Party. The 2000 Democratic nominee, Vice President Albert Gore, was the son of a U.S. senator and ill-positioned to challenge the politics of privileged descent. Bush's challenger in 2004, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, operated under a similar handicap. He was sponsored by another political dynasty, the Kennedys, was married to the rich widow of a Republican U.S. senator, was a member, like George W. Bush, of the elite Skull and Bones Society at Yale, and he even possessed another revealing link. He had served as Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts under Governor Michael Dukakis, the 1988 Democratic presidential nominee who was defeated by the elder George Bush. Never before had two men who had served simultaneously as governor and lieutenant governor of a state both run for president many years apart, and both been defeated by two different presidents of the other party, to say nothing of two who were father and son. Inbred and sclerotic vie as appropriate descriptions of the two parties' selection processes. Such continuity of power elites suggests little capacity for challenging the status quo. And, of course, the front-running Democrat for the 2008 presidential nomination is Hillary Clinton, from America's third major dynasty. For those of us who grew up thinking that the United States was different, the prospect that it probably is not different is a chastening one. Afterward, the changing Republican presidential coalition. The two major party presidential coalitions in the United States are a bit like mutating organisms. They change constantly in a minor way and occasionally in a major way. Over the last half century, both coalitions have been undergoing considerable and interrelated upheavals. My own focus has been on the GOP, which had a significant and ultimately inauspicious transformation as it took over the South. In The Emerging Republican Majority, published in 1969, I argued that the collapse of the old Civil War framework would create a conservative and Republican presidential majority. This took place in two stages. First, Richard Nixon, with 61% of the national vote in 1972, and Ronald Reagan, with 59% in 1984, put together the new coalition, including the South, while still keeping most of the old support in the North, albeit slipping in places like Vermont, Cape Cod, Princeton, and the fashionable neighborhoods of Manhattan and San Francisco. That slippage on the margins was to be expected. This ended under the two Bushes. By 1992, after President George H.W. Bush had redefined his politics toward the South and the religious right, he carried none of these nine states: Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Oregon, California. In 2000 and 2004, George W. Bush carried only one, Ohio, and by much smaller margins than Eisenhower, Nixon, or Reagan. The 1992 election, as this book's narrative makes clear, had potential watershed significance. Without Bill Clinton's personal moral shortcomings, the Democrats would have consolidated during the 1990s, won the 2000 election, and been in power to enjoy the rally-round effect after September 11, 2001. Instead, the increasingly religion-oriented and southernized Republicans won the White House in 2000 by a Supreme Court decision, enjoyed the rally-round benefits of September 11th, and still managed only a narrow victory in 2004. Bluntly putting it, I believe that a careful electoral analysis shows that what can be called the Bush coalition is too narrow to govern successfully and empowered only by a succession of odd circumstances in both 2000 and 2004 to win. Indeed, by 2006, George W. Bush had followed in his father's unique presidential footsteps. In 1991 to 1992, the 41st president had become the first White House incumbent to see his job approval plummet by more than 50 points. And between 2002 and 2005, his son followed suit. Both times, failed policies in Iraq were factors. Overambition combined with ineptness and more than a little deceit. By 2003 and 2004, the professed religiosity of the Republican electorate and congressional leadership, coupled with George W. Bush's periodic asides that God spoke through him, was becoming ever more defining of the GOP coalition and what it stood for. Prior to 2003, many of the new votes that the Republicans gained from religion took place in an essentially favorable crisis climate. The horrors of September 11th had fed a sense of end times among the faithful, while seeming to legitimize the younger Bush's biblical language and righteous nationalism. During this period, the theocratic implications, the depressing relation of Bush policies to aspects of the Left Behind series, and the pandering associated with the 2005 Schiavo episode were still little perceived. By 2005, the concern about the influence of the religious right visible in 2004 had taken hold, both in the polls and in national discussion. Thus, although no one can be sure what issues will dominate the next several presidential elections, it is useful to look at the Republican presidential coalition from a standpoint of religion, denominational biases, interest group power, theological correctness, and the consequent national vulnerabilities these entail. The red state versus blue state dimension of the 2000 and 2004 elections can plausibly be viewed in religious terms. For the Republicans, the old mainline denominations are no longer the pillars. There are three new regional underpinnings: the Southern Baptist Convention, the Mormons, Latter-day Saints, and the Lutheran denominations that captain Upper Midwest Protestantism. The fourth element, too dispersed to map well, although most numerous in the South, Middle West, and West, includes 1. The Pentecostals, notably the Assemblies of God, and 2. The so-called primitive and holiness denominations. The latter include the Churches of Christ, the Christian Churches, the Church of God, and the Church of the Nazarene. This Republican presidential coalition is weakest, in turn, in states with relatively large Catholic populations, sizable Jewish constituencies, high percentages of non-believers, and smaller Protestant populations with large mainline ratios. Episcopalian, Presbyterian, USA, Congregationalist, UCC, and Methodist. States meeting these cultural criteria concentrate in the Northeast, the Great Lakes, and the Pacific Coast. The battleground or new border states can also be located by a religious calculus. In the Northeast, Pennsylvania has the closest equivalent of an in-state Bible Belt and is not out of reach for the religious Republican coalition. Next door, Ohio, is the ultimate swing state, with the Cleveland area, 200 years ago, the Western Reserve of Connecticut, trending against the GOP coalition in 2004. Meanwhile, the Republicans gained among white born-again Protestants in southern Ohio and among rural and small-town Catholic and Lutheran Germans in the state's west. As noted in Chapter 6, the Southern Baptist Convention is mounting an expensive religious mobilization and conversion campaign in metropolitan Cleveland. This should benefit the GOP, as do the flows into southern and central Ohio from Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia. In 2004, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Missouri, the border states of 1861 to 1865 Civil War politics, lost that marginality because of their high ratios of Southern Baptists, Pentecostals, and Holiness denomination and other sectarian Protestants. Culturally, of course, John Kerry was a weak Democratic nominee. Still, if religion stays central and outweighs the economy, these states would probably again be more Republican than the nation as a whole. In both 2000 and 2004, Florida was the tightest state in the South for the GOP, being another cultural crossroads. However, religion doesn't seem to have been a particular plus or minus. Moving elsewhere, a slight caveat is necessary in describing Lutheranism as the religious linchpin in a block of states including Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, and the Dakotas. Some distinctions must be made among the several Lutheran denominations. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is centrist and more Scandinavian, especially Swedish and Norwegian, than German. By contrast, the more conservative and pro-Bush Missouri Synod and Wisconsin Synod Lutherans are predominantly German. While there are no recent studies to cite, my sense is that German ethnicity may have a closer correlation than Lutheranism per se with upper middle Western support for religiously infused conservatism in the 2000 and 2004 elections. Catholic German rural counties in the region, back in the late 19th century, largely democratic, began trending Republican in response to two world wars, consolidating that sentiment during the Reagan years. They are religious, traditional, and nationalistic, with an America First slant and a distaste for foreign aid and entanglement. In 2004, Bush did very well in these areas, as he did among Catholics and Lutherans, but perhaps even more among the various German-sprung sects, Old Order Amish, Hutterites, Moravians, Mennonites, and the like, that are often found interspersed in counties with high German Catholic or Lutheran populations. Behaviorally, if Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, and the Dakotas represent the region with the nation's highest ratios of Lutherans, and they do, they also represent the region with by far and away the nation's highest ratios of Germans. For those interested, a county-by-county map of the intensity of German-American population appears in my 1999 book, The Cousins Wars. In the first three of these states, all close in 2004, my guess is that Bush easily carried the Germans, Catholic, Lutheran, and sectarian, and probably lost the heavily Lutheran but more liberal Norwegians. However, if the U.S. involvement in Iraq continues to be embarrassing to Republicans through 2008, they could pay a major price among upper Midwestern Germans, who tend to turn against such overseas imbroglios if they drag out. Ross Perot, among other things, a critic of U.S. Middle Eastern policy, won a huge 1992 protest vote in the upper Midwest. As for the West, part of it is drawn to a conservative religious coalition, and part of it is not. The Pacific coastal areas of Washington, Oregon, and California are among the most secular portions of the United States, especially from Seattle and Portland south to San Francisco Bay and Silicon Valley. The Catholic, Jewish, and mainline Protestant ratios are also too high to support a conservative, evangelical, and fundamentalist religious coalition. However, the eastern interior sections of these states are more conservative and more like the Rocky Mountain states. On balance, though, Bush lost all three states in 2000 and 2004. The mountain states, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, Idaho, and Montana, all supported Bush in 2004, and all but New Mexico did in 2000. Nevertheless, it is an oversimplification to say they all support a conservative religious coalition. Those most committed in that direction, Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming, all rank among the nation's most conservative states. Utah and Idaho do so because of their heavy Mormon ratios, and Wyoming because its oil and ranching combine with a conservative Protestantism. Two of the mountain states stand to be marginal. Nevada's rapid growth and substantial Catholic, Jewish, and California emigre populations tilt its culture toward California. However, it also has substantial conservative, Mormon, and Southern Baptist religious populations. Like Ohio and Florida, Nevada is a demographic crossroads. New Mexico is marginal, partly because an atypical concentration of Hispanic Catholics offsets the Southern Baptist coloration of eastern New Mexico's Little Texas. Montana is another crossroads, between the plains and the mountains, but leans conservative nationally. Arizona and Colorado, by contrast, are increasingly sophisticated states with progressive urban centers, as well as Mormon, Southern Baptist, and other evangelical populations. In both 2000 and 2004, Arizona and Colorado briefly looked like swing states before coming down on the Bush side of the electoral ledger. Revealingly, as the 50 states sort out on a cultural and religious basis, the Republican coalition is starting to look like the reverse of the one that existed for generations after the Civil War. Not only does it rest on the Greater South instead of on Greater New England, but within key states like Ohio and Florida, Republican Party internal strength in presidential elections has reversed from the old Yankee geography of the 1940s and 1950s. Higher support in northern Ohio and in Yankee-settled South Florida. The new pattern involves greater Republican strength in southern and western Ohio and in cracker northern Florida. In short, the GOP's support base in the North is slowly moving toward the constituencies most comfortable with an essentially southern-leaning and religious Republican politics. However, this is an innately narrowed constituency, kept from any unnecessary broadening that might dilute its ideological and theological commitments. By pursuing these views, the new religious coalition draws attention to its narrowness and controversial theological mainsprings, which must then increase the controversy and electoral backlash. Unless, of course, another war or set of terrorist attacks can somehow restore the good versus evil moral and religious climate that existed in 2002. But this begs a second important question. Whether the GOP coalition is fatally flawed from a national interest standpoint? I think so, but not because of the basic cultural conservatism that did so well in the Nixon and Reagan landslides of 1972 and 1984. Both those coalitions had a flavoring of populist conservatism, but nothing resembling the current mix. Never before has a U.S. political coalition been so dominated by an array of outsider religious denominations caught up in biblical morality, distrust of science, and a global imperative of political and religious evangelicalism. These groups may represent only a quarter to a third of the U.S. population, but they are mobilized, as the turnout in 2004 showed. They also have important allies. As we have seen, the financial sector and a large majority of the richest Americans understandably finds the alliance convenient. Many of the fundamentalists, evangelical and Pentecostal faithful, are too caught up in religion, theology, and personal salvation to pay much attention to economics, and they are easily rallied for self-help, free enterprise, and disbelief in government. with much of the GOP's low and middle-income electorate listening to conservative preachers, the corporate and financial agenda not only prevails, but often runs riot. For the oil and gas industries, however, the alliance is a two-edged sword. True, the religious right and oil have developed a working compatibility in states like Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, and Colorado, and the religious right leadership generally disdains environmentalists and alternative energy backers. Still, much of the real world, as seen by cosmopolitan energy geologists and executives, cannot be publicly described in Republican national politics. The Book of Genesis and the Left Behind series both get in the way. We cannot be running out of oil. God makes the climate, and White House explanations about what the United States is doing in Iraq or elsewhere in the Middle East have to square with the fight between good and evil as the end times draw nigh. Much like intervention in Iraq, national energy strategy takes weak shape in a vacuum of candor. To be sure, as so many believers are sure, this time the prophecies could truly be on the verge of fulfillment. History, however, suggests that if the hour was not at hand for Rome, Spain, the Dutch Republic, or Britain circa 1914, despite their convictions of God's favor and heaven's special attention, then God may also spurn his Republican faithful in and out of Washington. And should religious excess and overambition become part of an epitaph for the 21st century United States, as it did for some of the others, the current GOP national coalition will share in the ignominy. This is not a cheery thought. In one way or another, I have been studying and writing about the emerging Republican presidential coalition for half a century now. I particularly regret this latest evolution under the two Bush presidents and my last three major books, Wealth and Democracy, 2002, American Dynasty, 2004, and American Theocracy, 2006, could be said to represent a trilogy of indictments, something I never imagined when I started writing The Emerging Republican Majority back in 1966. This is Scott Brick. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of American Theocracy. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Dan Musselman. American Theocracy is a production of Penguin Audio, a division of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated, and Books on Tape. Copyright 2006. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.